This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow.
And I'm Flora Lichtman.
Later in the wake of the fires in Los Angeles, we'll look at the science of urban fires and how to plan for them.
Plus, a novel about astronauts living on the International Space Station wins the Booker Prize. But first, a quick look at the news this week. Ira, what caught your eye?
Yeah, there was something really hard to believe that I discovered, and that is out of every 10 new cars sold in Norway, 9 are electric.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're aiming to make it 100% electric by the end of this year. I mean, and this isn't the country that's known for its oil and gas production.
So how did they pull it off?
It's the old story of slow and steady. They set a goal back in 2017, and they didn't ban gas cars. No, but they did tax them, gas and diesel fuel. And this is the good part. They offered a bunch of incentives to buy electric cars. They gave you free parking, discount on tolls. They even waived the VAT and import taxes. And the best part, you could even drive in the bus lane on the highway.
I'm sold.
So if you put it all together, that comes to about one third of all the cars on the road are electric. And I think that's pretty impressive. So what impressed you this week, Flora?
Well, a story I really liked came from our friends at the show Radiolab. So they teamed up with the International Astronomical Union and they ran this contest to name one of Earth's quasi-moons, which I learned is apparently not a moon, but also not a moon. It's like a hunk of rock that orbits the sun, but is close enough to a planet to seem like a moon. So anyway, they picked one near Earth that has a name that is not so catchy. It's like a string of a bunch of digits. And they held this contest and they got thousands of name submissions from people across the world. And this week, their panel picked a winner.
And drum roll, please.
Cardia.
Cardia.
Cardia, which is the Roman goddess of doorways and transitions, a kind of guardian of thresholds and protection, which I love. It seems like a perfect fit.
That is cool. That's a very creative choice. And speaking of moons, what a segue. Joining us now for even more space news and other stories of the week is Jason Dinn, climate editor at Atmos in Washington. Welcome back, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get right into the news about moons. This was a very busy week in spaceflight. On Thursday, a SpaceX test of its Starship system exploded shortly after launch. And that explosion is still under investigation, but it's believed to have been caused by a propellant leak. But another really exciting launch, also from SpaceX, was a rocket carrying not one, but two moon missions. Tell us about that.
Yeah, SpaceX launched this rocket carrying two landers that are headed to the moon. One belongs to a U.S. company, and another belongs to a Japanese company. They took off from the NASA Kennedy Space Center in Florida early Wednesday morning, and after about an hour, the two separated and are now taking different paths to the moon. The Japanese lander from a group called iSpace is going to gather soil, test the system that would cultivate food using algae, and test another system that splits water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen. And the American lander from a group called Firefly Aerospace is doing science with NASA. Some of the technologies they're testing include satellite navigation, computers adapted to radiation, and self-cleaning glass that wipes away sharp, abrasive lunar debris.
Oh, that's cool. So are these like competitors on the same vehicle?
No, they're not competitors. They don't see it that way. They're actually doing very different things. They're landing on different spots in the moon. They just shared this rocket to kind of save costs.
Yeah, they hitchhiked. Okay, what's the timeline here? When did they actually get to the moon?
The American lander is scheduled to touch down in early March, and the Japanese one expects to touch down in late May or early June. And once they're there, both plan to spend about 2 weeks operating.
Okay, let's go back to Earth for a moment for big food news. The FDA is moving to ban a common food dye. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this happened on Wednesday. The FDA banned the use of red dye number 3 in food, beverages, and drugs. What this means is that starting in 2027, companies are going to have to start removing red 3 from their products. Now, this is a petroleum-based food coloring that's used in all sorts of products you might have in your pantry, including certain candy corn, strawberry ice cream, and even bacon bits. And some companies have already started replacing red 3 with more natural dyes from beets or insects. Health advocates say that this decision was really long overdue. The ban comes more than 3 decades after Red 3 was first found to cause cancer in male lab rats. And the FDA banned Red 3 from cosmetics and topical drugs way back in 1990. Other places like Europe, Australia, and New Zealand have banned it from food too. But these countries did make one kind of amusing exception, which are maraschino cherries that are candied or used in cocktails.
Huh, maraschino cherries. Oh, so how solid is the evidence here? Do we really know if this dye is potentially harmful? It would seem so.
So the FDA is obliged to not approve any food additives that are cancerous to humans or non-human animals, which is why that rat study is important. They did downplay the risk to humans in their announcement. So while there is a known cancer risk in male lab rats, they said that they haven't found that in any other animal, including humans. Some critics and advocates do argue that maybe the only reason there's no known cancer risk in humans is that food safety research has been historically underfunded. So just because there's no known risk doesn't necessarily mean that that risk doesn't exist. It's possible that it's just been undiscovered.
Yeah, I'm reminded of other food colors and colorations and dyes that have been banned in the past. All right, let's go on to other health news this week. There's a new study out looking at potential cases of dementia in the future. Tell us about that one.
This paper was published in the journal Nature Medicine, and it projected that by 2060, new cases of dementia will double to 1 million new cases per year. And among Black Americans, it's going to triple. If the projections bear out, that would mean 12 million Americans with dementia in 2060, which is up from 6 million Americans now. There are a few reasons for this. So the first and more minor one is that dementia risk from this study was higher than the previous estimates. The study found that after turning 55, the risk of developing dementia at some point in your life is 42%, and that risk increases with age. But the real main driver of this trend is that our population is aging. By 2060, some of the youngest baby boomers are going to be in their 90s, and many millennials are going to be in their 70s. So a huge portion of our population are going to be at the old ages where the risk of dementia is greatest.
So are they talking about anything people can do to lessen their own risks of dementia?
Totally. There are ways to manage risk factors. The researchers suggest improving heart health through medicine or lifestyle changes, preventing and treating strokes, and wearing hearing aids once you need them. You know, being able to hear keeps you socially and cognitively engaged.
Cool. This next one, I know there's AI in everything these days, but now it appears it's in snake anti-venom design. Wow. Who knew?
Yeah, this is a really cool study. It was published in Nature this week. And these researchers used AI to design proteins that could be used in anti-venoms. These proteins were designed to latch on to specific toxins in the venom and prevent them from harming cells and tissues. The way the process worked is that the AI designed a protein, the researchers manufactured it, and then they injected it into mice that were given otherwise lethal doses of venom toxins. And these AI proteins ended up saving those mice's lives. It's a proof of concept that the researchers say could one day be applied to devise a new treatment for snake bites. And that's actually quite important because while snake anti-venoms exist, the technology is pretty archaic. They literally milk a snake for venom, inject it into a horse or another large animal, and then harvest the antibodies that that animal produces. These AI designed proteins are, in theory, quicker and more cost effective to produce. They circumvent the need to use animals. And some researchers even told reporters that they think the proteins might not need to be refrigerated, which means that they could be stored and used in remote, hot, tropical places where snake bites still pose significant health risk.
Wow, that's a win-win-win. I mean, now, if you can use this to design proteins for the antivenin, could you also use it to design other kinds of drugs or pharmaceuticals?
100%. This is all part of a larger movement to use AI to predict protein structures and functions in ways that we couldn't have fathomed even years ago. It builds off of the AI protein research that won last year's Nobel Prize in chemistry. And David Baker, who was one of those Nobel laureates, is actually the senior author of this paper. The authors very explicitly say in their paper that beyond snake bites, these results show how AI could be used to democratize drug discovery, especially for places that are strapped for resources and for diseases that have been historically neglected.
All right. We're going to end with something, you know, one of our famous Science Friday stories we like to talk about on a Friday night. And this one is research into tattoos of ancient mummies. Am I getting this right?
You're totally right. Researchers just applied the technology used to study dinosaur fossils to visualize tattoos on 1,000-year-old mummies in Peru. I don't know if any of you have ink like I do, but if you do, you're probably aware that your tattoo fades and bleeds over time. And that's a real challenge for scientists trying to visualize ancient skin art. The technique these researchers used allowed them to see these tattoos through that fade and through that ink bleed. It's called laser-stimulated fluorescence. Essentially, they shine a laser on the mummy so the skin glows, and that creates a sharp contrast with the black ink. They used that technology to look at a wide range of tattoos, some that were geometric shapes, some that were based on nature, like vines, animals, and scales. And the big surprise was that the tattoo lines were shockingly thin. They were 0.1 to 0.2 millimeters wide, which is finer than the lines that most modern tattoo needles lay down today. The authors think that they were laid down using a very fine instrument like a cactus needle or a sharpened animal bone, but there's still disagreement from outside experts on that. The bigger picture here is that by learning who was tattooed, what those tattoos depicted, and how they were laid down can reveal the deeper cultural meaning of skin art. So whether it's aesthetic, therapeutic, ritual, or a class signal, the smaller picture is that all of us with tattoos can now hope that we become mummified. So 1,000 years from now, scientists can gape at our really cool skin art.
Well, there's no way to top that ending, Jason. I hope you get your wish on that one. Jason Dinh, climate editor at Atmos in Washington, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
After the break, the science behind urban fires. Stay with us.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Since January 7th, the news has been filled with the fires devastating Los Angeles.
It's been a week since two of the most destructive wildfires in California history erupted in Los Angeles.
The flames are just kind of leaping right over us.
The multiple blazes combined, singeing nearly 40,000 acres in Southern California, decimating communities.
The threat of fires is growing in cities around the U.S., especially in a zone called the Wildland-Urban Interface, or as it's known, WUI. That's where unoccupied wildland and human developments meet and mingle. In the U.S., around 1 in 3 homes are in this high-risk zone. So what's the science behind urban fires, and how do we protect ourselves in the face of them? Here to discuss all these issues are my guests, Dr. Kimiko Barrett, senior wildfire researcher and policy analyst at the research group Headwaters Economics in Bozeman, Montana, Dr. Alexandra Seifert, senior research scientist at the Conservation Biology Institute in San Diego, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Barrett, tell me more about the risks of fires in the WUI interface. Why is that so dangerous?
So the WUI, which is a terrible acronym for the Wildland-Urban Interface, is indeed this location, this area where homes intermingle and meet the unbuilt wildlands or the vegetation around these communities. It is indeed the fastest growing land use type in the lower 48 states and accounts for around 44 million households at this time. It is also the most exposed area to wildfires. So we have climate change exacerbating extreme wildfire behavior, and then we have ongoing development in wildfire prone lands. And the way with which that development is taking place is often done with little thought or foresight for wildfire risk mitigation, meaning how, where, and under what conditions homes are being placed in high-risk locations.
Well, Dr. Seifert, does LA fit that description very well?
Yeah, in fact, I would say Southern California in general has kind of been like the apotheosis of the WUI. It's always sort of stood out as the classic example of where development meets fire-prone landscapes. And we have been experiencing housing losses to wildfire here in Southern California for decades. And it's something that's not new, but we are also experiencing some unprecedented things, such as the amount of house loss that's been occurring. It's been increasing not only in California, but also across the globe, and is due to a number of factors that, importantly, are different in different regions of the state and other parts of the world.
Such as?
Such as, one distinction that I think is critically important that is difficult for people to understand, especially if they don't live in California, is that Southern California is a non-forested landscape. In other words, it does not have trees. It has shrublands that have been invaded by very flammable grasses, whereas the forests have experienced a different kind of problem. They typically have very frequent fire, but that fire has been removed from those landscapes. So they have a lot of fuel accumulation, vegetation accumulation, high density fire that creates different problems. In Southern California, what's happened is that with Santa Ana winds that, as you've seen in the news, can blow 70 miles an hour, and the vegetation is extraordinarily flammable and does not stop the wildfires here.
So why don't we have a burning of this vegetation like we do in other areas in forests to get rid of the fuel?
Yeah, the thing that's different is that in forests, we thin from below, and we often follow it with prescribed fire, and that creates and mimics the natural conditions of the forest and reduces the likelihood that those fires will become very tall, high flame lengths, as we call them, and reach into the crown and become extraordinarily dangerous to anybody adjacent to those fires. But in Southern California, the problem here is that we have had so much fire, so much uncharacteristically highly frequent fire. And when the winds are blowing in Southern California, the vegetation does not readily stop the fires. And in fact, when the vegetation converts from sort of higher fuel moisture chaparral vegetation, which does produce high intensity fires, but when it turns into grassland, this is just kindling for fire propagation under severe winds. And what I mean by that is that most of the fire spread in these Santa Ana wind conditions is actually going through the air instead of the vegetation. Millions of little embers are flying through the air. They can cross 10-lane freeways. And whatever they land on, how flammable that is whether or not it's going to create a spot fire and then keep the fire moving that much farther and that much faster. And so a lot of times, the typical vegetation management that's so effective and critical in forests just doesn't have the same effect in Southern California at a landscape scale. Instead, it's really more important when it's around individual houses and right. When it provides a safe place for firefighters to get in and do the good work that they do.
Kimmy, what happens when the embers are traveling? I mean, what factors affect if a house burns or not?
I just really loved Dr. Seifert's explanation here because, indeed, embers account for a vast majority of home loss during a wildfire. Statistics are on the range of around 90% of home loss is a result of, as Dr. Seifert said, these tiny balls of flame. And so when we think through these embers flying so far ahead of that wildfire front, these balls of flame and billions of them under a high wind event, if they land on a flammable surface area, they can grow into that spot fire, as Dr. Seifert noted. So it's bark mulch around a home, for example, or it's what is on top of a deck. It's the deck itself in some situations. It's what's underneath that deck. If you have pine needles, if you have vegetation in your gutters, if the roof itself is made of wood, all of these factors collectively greatly influence that vulnerability to ignition from embers. And then once the home itself starts to burn, you're dealing then with radiant heat as another form of exposure. And the home itself becomes a source of fuel. And that's very, very important when we think through these conflagrations that lead to disasters.
All right. So now that we know what the factors are and how these fires work, how do we plan for them, Alexandra? I mean, what can we do to build a less risky fire zone?
Yeah, great question. I think the short answer is that we need to consider multiple strategies at one time because it's not going to take just one action to make Los Angeles as well as other cities more fire resilient. you could first start with, invariably, the structures are going to go back where they were before. And Gavin Newsom has facilitated that with his executive order. So what we hope, first of all, is that they are built up to the codes. The buildings built after 2008 in California have been built to a fire code that has significantly reduced the risk of homes burning that are newer. Of course, it's important to also mention that no house is fireproof. And while these measures all substantially reduce risk, they do not eliminate it. I don't want to create false sense of safety, but it starts with building back in a fire safe way. It starts with education about defensible space and where it's most important, which is usually the first 0 to 5 feet around the house. It involves having adequate ingress and egress so people can safely get in and out during a wildfire event. And ultimately, I think city planning should start thinking about where certain land uses are placed relative to one another. And ultimately, you know, every house in the wildland urban interface right now is a function of decisions that people made 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so we have the opportunity now. We can't get rid of the existing development, but we have the opportunity now to say, where do we want to put our new houses in the future?
Is there any way to retrofit your home or retrofit your building?
Yes, we do know that mitigation strategies to the home itself can go to great lengths to reduce ignition exposure. Some of the most effective mitigation strategies are also the most affordable in the sense of removing the flammable surface area in and around the home. So it is looking at that decking, what's on top of it, what's on top of your roof, what type of mulch do you have, what's your vegetation around the home itself. And then when you go on the larger scale, some of these bigger retrofits, like a roof replacement, for example, that is going to be a cost. And that is something that homeowners will have to thoughtfully budget into their account or seek and get subsidy support if available through local fire districts in California. They do have funds available. It's surely not to the degree that is going to meet the scale of retrofitting needs, nor is it available at the federal level the way it needs to be.
We know that socially vulnerable populations are disproportionately impacted by wildfire. Socially vulnerable populations experience fire more often than affluent populations. And also the recovery is nearly impossible for somebody who doesn't have insurance or have the resources to deal with that. And so one strategy might be to identify those places that are most at risk for fire and where the people really need the help the most. But also, as Kimmy was mentioning, there are some things that are really not that expensive. And people shouldn't get discouraged and say, well, I can't get a new roof, so I'm not going to do anything. It's better to at least do something than to do nothing at all.
Let me go to Kimmy. I understand that the city of Austin, Texas, used its experience with a huge wildfire in 2011 to think and rebuild better. Is Austin, does it give us any hints of about what to do?
It certainly can be an example of the process with which they have very thoughtfully and deliberately thought about living with increasing wildfire risk, knowing that their city and their communities within that city were going to be exposed to increasing risk down the road. And so what elected officials did there in partnership with the city of Austin, including the fire districts, of course, but not just stopping there, local arborists, architects, the construction industry itself, they went through a very methodical process of going through a wildland urban interface code adoption. But in Austin, they went through a learning process in that they tried to adopt it first in 2018, and it failed because it did not have the full buy-in from all the partners and stakeholders on the ground. So the City of Austin Fire Department went back to the table. They brought in the right partners. They brought in the government association, the building industry. They very thoughtfully went through the building materials that were being requested. And in doing so, they bought in, they approved the building material list. They did actually in turn advocate for the WUI code adoption, and it was unanimously adopted in 2020. That is the city of Austin. It's the fastest growing metropolitan area in the country. They do have a lot of resources and a lot of capital to help them support this type of building code adoption. and WUI code adoption, but that isn't to say that communities elsewhere facing similar increasing risk can't replicate that type of process and also adopt these codes and regulations that do work and do reduce risk in the future to wildfire.
What about with climate change, though? Many coastal areas have made new rules saying, hey, you can't build here. It might be underwater soon. I mean, can you make similar rules for fires?
You know, I think it's a very valid question. It's complicated in the sense that these risks are manifesting at a very local scale. Embercast accounts for a huge distance spread of how that risk is buffered into a community. So is there truly any place that is safe from a wildfire here in the West? All of these questions really compound and confound that crisis of what does safe development look like in the future. There is the argument to be made that if you cannot mitigate from all of these sources of potential exposure from a wildfire, should you allow development to occur in the first place? And I think that's really a community question to ask and is going to guide how and where and under what conditions development occurs, knowing that wildfires are inevitable and knowing that these risks are going to increase. That is a reality we must live with.
What gives you hope that, you know, all these factions can band together and fix this problem, Kimmy?
So I would actually lean on a great wildfire historian. I know that Alexandra knows him as well, Steve Pine. And what he remarks is that you look at the Western settlement, European settlement in the late 19th century through the 20th century, and we routinely built our cities and our urban areas, and they continually burned down over and over again. We had the Chicago and the Peshtigo fire of 1871. Later, we had the San Francisco fire of 1906. You know, it's worth noting 1,200 people died in the Peshtigo and Chicago fire. And after these devastating events, and again, particularly the 1906 San Francisco fire, we as a society decided to fundamentally do things very, very differently in the sense of structural interior fires. We stopped using wood and sawdust. We started putting in evacuation protocols and exit doors and exit strategies and interior fire hydrants and stopped using wooden boardwalks. And we don't have that sense of interior structural fire to the same degree that we did in the past. And so Steve Pine always remarks, you know, in that sense, we have solved this problem before from an interior structural perspective. We can do so again if we apply those lessons learned outward looking at the wildlands.
You know, I'm reminded of a study from a few years ago about how the communities that are more resilient to climate change tend to be the ones where neighbors know each other. Right? I mean,
yeah.
Doesn't community play a role in how we live with fires, Alexandra?
This is a great point, because one of the things that we've been talking about among us fire scientists lately is the importance of doing these actions at a community scale where people all get together and they maintain their yards and they retrofit their houses. And the idea is that on one hand, if you have everybody who's done everything right, and one person who's done it wrong, that person is actually, their safety is increased by virtue of the fact that all their neighbors have done something good, but it's the flip side as well. If you're one person and you've made your house very fire resilient, but none of your neighbors have, you're also at a higher risk. So there is something about looking into whether we can, as communities together, work together to become more fire safe and resilient.
Well, our hearts go out to everybody who's affected in the Los Angeles area, and we hope it's more than prayers that will help them recover. Thank you. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Dr. Kimiko Barrett, Senior Wildfire Researcher and Policy Analyst at Headwaters Economics, that's in Bozeman, Montana, and Dr. Alexandra Seifert, Senior Research Scientist at the Conservation Biology Institute in San Diego, California. We have to take a break, and when we come back, we sit down with an author and an astronaut about a novel that explores what it's like living aboard the International Space Station. Stay with us.
This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. From Earth, living on the International Space Station can seem, I don't know, kind of magical. Floating through the day, the view out your window is stunning. You're having this experience only a handful of other people will ever get. But what's it really like? How does experiencing 16 sunrises and 16 sunsets every day change your perception of time? How do you cope with being so far from the people that you love? These are some of the questions explored in the new novel Orbital, which won the Booker Prize late last year. The author, Samantha Harvey, imagines the inner life of astronauts aboard the ISS, which is why I really wanted to put Samantha in conversation with an astronaut who lived that life. So today we have novelist Samantha Harvey, along with astronaut Katie Coleman. Katie spent almost 6 months on the International Space Station and is an author herself. She's joining us from New England Public Media in Amherst, Massachusetts. I am so thrilled to have you both on to talk about this book and life in space. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Hi, Flora. Hi, Katie.
So nice to be here.
Do you two know each other?
I feel like we do. And yet we actually just met at an interview before Christmas, you know, and over the airwaves, so to speak. And I already wanted to be friends. In fact, I thought we already were just from reading the book.
This is the highlight of my career. I must say that an astronaut wants to be my friend.
Samantha, why the ISS? Why this subject?
Well, I wanted really to write about the Earth more than about space at the beginning. I wanted to write something like a pastoral novel, something that was about the natural world. And I somehow ended up in low Earth orbit, sort of a little bit unwittingly, and thought, well, you know, with the images of the Earth from there, and there's lots of footage that we can enjoy now, us Earthlings, they're just so extraordinary in every way. And they sort of asked me, I think, to reevaluate my sense of my own place on the Earth. And there was something in the feeling of that, of looking at those images, that was incredibly powerful and a driver to want to write about it. So I thought, well, I wonder if I can write this sort of pastoral novel, but from an extraordinary viewpoint. And once I decided that I wanted to write about the Earth from that distance, then I, you know, realized, of course, I need some kind of locus for that. So that ended up being the ISS. And then there was, you know, an enormous amount of research that I had to do to set it from there. But the impetus for the project was really an emotional one, just wanting to capture in words the extraordinary view of the planet and what I felt when I looked at it.
I want to talk about this exact thing because early on in the book, one of the astronauts laments that it's difficult to put the experience into words. So you write, she finds she often struggles for things to tell people at home because the small things are too mundane and the rest is too astounding and there seems to be nothing in between. And when I read this, I thought this was funny because I was like, well, that's, of course, exactly what this book does so beautifully is to put it into words. And I'm wondering, Katie, does this ring true to you that it's hard to sort of explain what it's like to be up there?
It definitely is. And I think more importantly, each of us has our own experience up there. And I'll say, you know, not always with the skills to express that. And so, you know, every part of it isn't my experience, but it for me, actually, it helped me sort of go back to the space station and feel like I was back there. But I feel like Samantha brought up these different points of view for people to try them on, whether they're astronauts who've lived up there or people on Earth wondering what it's like to be up there. So I think she lays out some of the possibilities.
Samantha, was this part of the challenge of writing the book, actually sort of translating this otherworldly rare experience into words?
I mean, yes, but of course I haven't had the experience, albeit that I did do a lot of reading of astronauts' journals and the books that they've written. So I think a lot of that translation was from imagery that I could see online. So speaking to Katie is so fascinating to me. And it feels like, you know, there's my realm, the book that I've written, which is functioning entirely in the realm of the imagination. And then there's the realm of experience. And I'm interested in how those two things speak to each other.
I'm interested in that too. I mean, Katie, did reading Samantha's imagined version lead you to realize or sort of learn anything new about your own experience?
It absolutely did. And I think Samantha brought me back to so many little moments and touch points that it really helped me sort of re-experience my life on the space station. And it was everything from, I mean, we wake up in the morning and you always look at the morning messages. And she had some expression like, the sort of greeting from the ground of the morning mail on the computer. And it just was this really delightful way to say it that I really loved. So I just really, I there's all sorts of little bookmarks. And I have places where I wrote no, or just an N, right?
Really?
It's really interesting to hear you say that. And when I was writing the book, the thing I was most acutely aware of all the time was that although I can do my research, ultimately this is an imaginative project. And so I can only bring myself to it. And I am so fundamentally and constitutionally not an astronaut. You know, there's
I don't know, Sam.
How do you mean?
I think the jury is out.
I mean, okay, I'm not practical. I am travel sick.
Me too, sometimes. Seasick, anyway.
Are you? That's interesting. I am emotionally not terribly robust when it comes to quite sort of overwhelming experiences. I think I would just spend my time in tears. There's a character in the book who is one of the female astronauts' husbands, and I'm him, basically. He's this sort of guy who lives in a field in the countryside and just imagines himself going into space and going mad and thwarting the mission. And that would be me, I think. So I kept wondering, are my imaginative capacities going to be enough to escape the prism of my own non-astronautness? So this was really in my mind the whole time I was writing. Can I do this? Is this a step too far? Is this a set of characters I really am not equipped to write about? So to know where it does chime and where it doesn't chime is so fascinating to me.
Well, I'm looking at just two pages and I have, I don't know, six things underlined that delighted me. Okay.
Read them. What are they?
Let's see. This is pages 84 and 85. And they're talking about scuba diving, but I think they're also talking about being in space. And just the depth of the color blue, Nell agrees. Just the light, the color, the creatures, the coral, the sounds, just everything. Pietro agrees. Just everything. And so even though they're talking about what they see when they scuba dive, these are two people in space that I think emotionally are expressing like where we are, the way we feel, everything from living here to the Earth right outside our window. You know, it's just everything. So I really loved it.
Sam, what's it like for you to hear Katie, an astronaut who's lived this life, respond to your book in this way?
Oh, wow. It makes me feel quite tearful. it's really magical. And actually, when I was writing the book or when it came out, I think somebody mentioned to me the prospect of sending it to an astronaut or an astronaut reading it. And I thought, oh, God, I hope no astronaut ever reads it.
So I have to ask them. So I know when I wrote my book, you know, I actually was that I would think, oh, what if other astronauts read this? Will they think, oh, that's not exactly right? Will they think, you know, oh, that's too much to say? Or, you know, and I wrote this book with someone else, a co-writer. And she said, Katie, everyone has that 100 people that they hear in their ear. Did you hear us in your ear?
Yeah, I did a little bit. I did. And I could sort of, because I felt that while I was writing the book, that although I loved writing it, and although I was very committed to it, it also felt continually like an act of trespass, that I was writing about something I had no right to write about because it's something I can't ever experience. And that's a funny thing, because I've written, all of my books are about things I've never experienced. That's what I love to do. I don't really like to write autobiographically. So I don't know what that sense of trespass was, except that I suppose astronauts as a group are fairly formidable. They feel it in the public consciousness. I think that's why it's so amazing to have this personal exchange with you, Katie, because astronauts exist in the public imagination, I think, as almost mythical beings. I think, you know, when we're children, you know, we often want to be astronauts, or at least we're very aware of that as some sort of job, but not a real job anyone could ever have. And I think some of that has carried through for me. I think I felt that when I was writing the book, that of course you're not mythical beings, but there's something mythical about space travel. There's something in the public imagination there that feels sort of inaccessible. And I think I was picking up on that while I was writing the book, and at the same time trying to use that, you know, trying to exploit that sense of the dreamscape, the otherness of it, the extraordinariness, and to create a kind of suspended narrative. So it feels like a real culmination of everything to be able to speak to you about it.
Well, it's such a special world, but I think that you've done exactly the right thing, and it's maybe one of the reasons that we're here on Science Friday, is that we have to make, you know, the impossible seem like it's accessible to everyone.
You know, what I love about this book so much, and what I love about the work that you do, Katie, is that you're humanizing science, and science isn't always humanized very well, which I personally feel like is a big missed opportunity.
Me too.
And Sam, I wondered if, you know, now that you've immersed yourself in this astronaut world, if you might take on another sciencey subject in a future novel, or how you think about this intersection.
That's a good question. I mean, I tend not to tread the same ground twice with my novels, probably much to my editor's dismay. One of the great sort of joys of this book has been this intersection with the sciences, which is the part of the process that daunted me the most, because I'm evidently not a scientist, but it's been the sort of the way the scientific world has taken it in and been welcoming to it on the whole. People have been incredibly receptive to it, which I've found very sort of generous of spirit in a sense, because you have this imposter, you know, coming in, making things up about your field. And I think that's been received with an incredible amount of graciousness, actually. And so I don't know if I'll ever do something like this again, but certainly having done it this one time has been probably the most expansive experience I've had of publication.
Samantha, before we go, you've talked about how this book in some ways is a eulogy to the ISS, which is almost at the end of its life. NASA has plans to decommission it in 2030, and then it will eventually break up in the atmosphere. After having spent so much time with it, will you be sad to see it go?
I'll be really sad to see it go. I think because I have a slightly sort of romanticized idea of everything, I do see the ISS already with a kind of nostalgia of something that belongs to an era of peaceful cooperation between humans. And I see it as this sort of lovely, a kind of time capsule almost, something that's got, carries the hopes and dreams of a post-Cold War era. And I think that we're moving into something quite different now. And the unknownness of that is, you know, can be unsettling. So I think that I will feel rather sad when it's gone. I did ask, when Katie and I last spoke, I think I asked you, Katie, if you would feel sad about its deorbiting, and you seemed to be more sanguine about it and less romantically involved somehow than I am. So I appreciate again that my ideas of it are somewhat couched in a romanticized ideology of it, and maybe not in the reality of it and the fact that we need to move on.
I do think about it a little differently, and then I would just change a word in what you just said, that, you know, we have to move on. We get to move on. Mm. And so the ISS now, if we could, we would probably build it differently and less expensively, really, and more in have it be a more accessible place. So in a way, even though the ISS is going away, your book is a timeless snapshot of different points of view of what it's like to be a human in that special place.
That's a really That's a really wonderful coda, I think. And I think right there in that amendment from we have to move on to we get to move on is exactly why I'm not an astronaut and you are. I sort of think, oh, well, I guess we have to progress. If we must, then we will. Whereas I think that mindset that progress is positive, it's beautiful, it can be good. It's not always good, but it can be good. Is very much part of this sort of wonderful curiosity that it seems to be common among all astronauts, and this willingness to embrace the new, which I think I unfortunately lack.
I think you understood a lot.
Thank you.
I think that's the perfect place to leave it. I have so enjoyed this conversation. Thank you both for taking the time to talk to us today.
Well, thanks so much. It was it takes me back, and I really appreciate both of you for your role in doing that.
Yeah, thank you so much to you both.
Samantha Harvey is author of the Booker Prize-winning novel Orbital, and Katie Coleman is a former NASA astronaut and author of the book Sharing Space, An Astronaut's Guide to Mission, Wonder, and Making Change. If you, like me, could listen to this conversation between Katie and Samantha forever, we will put an extended cut on the Science Friday podcast on Tuesday. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Lots of folks helped make this show happen this week, including
Rasha Aridi,
Sandy Roberts,
Shoshana Buxbaum,
Danielle Johnson.
Thank you, everybody. You can email us too. Our address is scifry@sciencefriday.com. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow.
Have a great weekend. I'm Flora Lichtman. This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. We're starting the hour with some good vaccine news. A new study found that cervical cancer deaths in young women have plummeted since the introduction of the human papillomavirus vaccine. HPV is the most common sexually transmitted infection, and it can cause cancers of the mouth, throat, and sexual organs. It's also the cause of nearly every case of cervical cancer. The vaccine for HPV was introduced in 2006. Now, almost 20 years later, cervical cancer deaths in young women are down 62%. And researchers say there is only one reason this could be: the HPV vaccine. Joining me now to talk about this is Dr. Ashish Deshmukh, professor of public health sciences and co-leader of the Cancer Prevention and Control Program at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about your study, Ashish. So just so I have my mind around it, your study looked specifically at women under 25. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And in that group, you are seeing this big drop in deaths from cervical cancer over the last decade or so. And that drop correlates to when you would expect to see a drop in deaths because of the introduction of the HPV vaccine. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. Because the way HPV vaccination works, it first prevents infections, HPV. They will then after observe decline in cervical cancer incidence rate and then drop in cervical cancer deaths.
Got it. Okay, so this is a correlation study. Did you look at whether there are other possible explanations for why you see deaths from cervical cancer dropping?
It's unlikely, because we know that sexual behaviors have not changed in the United States. We know that HPV vaccination rates are increasing. We speculate that there are two possible reasons, both attributable to HPV vaccination. So individuals who received HPV vaccine, they are likely to have benefited. But in addition to that, there may be substantial health protection attributable to HPV vaccination.
Did you see changes in cervical cancer rates or precancers as well?
We did, because in our previous research, we observed that, so the HPV vaccination was introduced in 2006. And our speculation or hypothesis for this study was that we will observe a decline in cervical cancer deaths. And this hypothesis was driven by the fact that we published previous studies. A few years ago, we published another study in JAMA, where we observed that among youngest age group, cervical cancer incidence rate or occurrence of new cases of cervical cancer dropped 62%, again 12% per year. And what we observed in this study is that the decline in mortality followed decline in incidence.
Tell me a little more about HPV. There are multiple strains, right?
Yes. So it's the most common sexually transmitted infection. There are more than 200 types of HPV. But types 16 and 18, they're responsible for causing most cancer types.
And does the vaccine cover 16 and 18?
It does. So the first iteration of vaccine, it covered HPV types 6, 11, 16, and 18. And the most recent version of the vaccine prevents 9 HPV infection types.
Does the vaccine give you lifelong immunity?
From what we have seen so far, from the observational studies and studies from other countries, is that as a result of vaccination, there has been substantial decline. Now, lifelong immunity, it's area of current research. But again, our speculation is that it would prevent infection, at least cause an infection over substantial duration of time.
So your study looked at young women under 25, and the changes were profound, but we're also talking about a relatively small group. I mean, the drop was from 50 to 60 deaths a year to 13. Is that right?
Yes.
So when does cervical cancer usually onset in women?
Sure. So cervical cancer is still fairly rare in this age group. The peak age at cervical cancer onset is among women who are in their 30s and 40s, where most cases of cervical cancers are observed.
That's interesting that it's 30s and 40s. That seems still relatively young.
It is. Cervical cancer is the type of HPV-associated cancers that occurs among young individuals.
Hmm. When might we expect to have data on whether we're going to see the same drops in cervical cancer in this older cohort?
I think we'll have to wait for at least 10 to 15 years. And what we speculate is that in future years, we will see even greater decline because the birth cohort as they age and the burden of HPV-associated cancer or number of cases are higher in women who are in their 30s and 40s. So if the effect that we see persists in the consecutive age groups, we will see substantial drop in cervical and other HPV-associated cancers in next 10 to 15 years.
Do you think that cervical cancer could be eradicated with this vaccine?
It can. So there are two ways we can prevent cervical cancer through HPV vaccination. So we call it primary prevention or primary prophylaxis and screening for cervical cancer. So if we ensure that HPV vaccination rates are adequately achieved, we have a goal in front of us, 80% HPV vaccination coverage. And if we ensure that nearly all women are adherent to cervical cancer screening guidelines, it's possible that we completely eradicate HPV-associated cervical cancers.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. And I think what's most amazing about cervical cancer and other HPV-associated malignancies is that these are types of cancers that are completely preventable through HPV vaccination. We have a vaccine that prevents against 6 cancer types. To me, it's a public health revolution.
Well, I was going to say, are there other cancers that could be eradicated through vaccines, or is there something special about this group of HPV-related cancers?
I think it's special about HPV vaccination because of the fact that it's infection-driven malignancy. And this is the only vaccine which has been shown to be highly efficacious for all 6 cancer types. It's special about HPV vaccine that it has the potential to eliminate all 6 cancer types.
So you've been studying HPV and related cancers for many years. Why does this interest you?
So I started studying HPV-associated malignancies since my doctorate days program. I went to my mentor and he suggested I have several projects. And one of those was focused on anal cancer. I was intrigued by anal cancer because I lost my grandmother to anal cancer. At that time, I had no idea that anal cancer is caused by HPV. And that's how I got into HPV research.
Wow. Yeah, it's personal.
It is.
You know, I was thinking too, women's health, you know, as we know, has not historically been given as much attention. And of course, these HPV cancers can affect both men and women. But, you know, for cervical cancer, it obviously only affects people with a cervix. And I was wondering if for you, it was a conscious choice to sort of spend your time on this when sometimes women's health can be overlooked.
It is. And it is an area of major concern. I mean, not just cervical cancer. If we look at HPV-associated anal cancer among women, it has been recognized as one of the fastest rising causes of cancer incidence and mortality. Anal cancer is rising among women at 3 to 5% per year, and there's nothing we can do except HPV vaccination. it is potentially preventable, similar to cervical cancer, and we are trying our best to ensure that we identify ways to prevent anal cancer, again, both through primary prevention and secondary prevention. So I feel that for HPV-associated cancers, and when we think of women's health, it's imperative that we focus on HPV-associated malignancies.
I remember when the HPV vaccine was rolled out in 2006. I was too old at the time to be eligible, but I remember distinctly some opposition, especially from parents, because HPV is a sexually transmitted infection, and parents were like, well, my kids aren't sexually active, so they don't need this. Do you still encounter that mindset?
We do. I think there is still a strong hesitancy towards HPV vaccination. And again, I think this hesitancy is driven by the fact that the vaccine has been always perceived as something that prevents sexually transmitted infection. I think we need to change the way we talk about HPV vaccine and think of this as a cancer prevention vaccine, an infection prevention vaccine. I think that may help change parental perception. But in our research, we do see substantial vaccine hesitancy. In fact, in one of our recent studies, we observed that among parents of unvaccinated adolescents, 60% still lack intent to initiate HPV vaccination, which is a major barrier in the U.S.
Wow, 60%. So it needs a rebrand.
Right.
How old can you be to get the HPV vaccine and have it still be effective?
Sure. So the vaccine eligibility is up to age 45. And it is covered by insurance.
So, you know, we've been reading, seeing everywhere that childhood vaccination rates have been dropping since the COVID pandemic. Are we seeing the same thing with HPV?
We are. So in the most recent birth cohort, HPV vaccination rates have dropped. And this drop is, I think, up to 4%. What we're also observing is in the last 3 to 4 years, collectively, HPV vaccination rates have stagnated across age groups.
What about in other countries?
So we don't have similar evidence in other countries. I know in other developed nations like Australia, vaccination rates have been high and they have been able to achieve or are closer to achieving 80% vaccination goal.
Is that our goal too? Or what's your goal? What do you want to see?
So we need to ensure that we vaccinate all our adolescents who are eligible.
100% is your goal.
100% is our goal.
I'm going to give you Ira's blank check question. Ashish, if you had a blank check, you could do what you wanted. Resources were no issue. Where would you take your research? What would you do?
So I will ensure and I'll try my best to ensure that both primary and secondary prevention is possible. There are several countries, India, China, for instance, where there's substantial burden of cervical cancer. But we don't have adequate supply of HPV vaccination. Things are changing now in recent years. So worldwide, I will ensure that HPV vaccination is adequately administered for cancers such as anal cancer. We don't have screening infrastructure, which is a steep climb for us because it's also driven by the fact that we don't have enough providers who are adequately trained to perform anal cancer screening. So if we have resources, we'll ensure that screening is available, particularly in communities that are marginalized, underserved.
Ashish, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
That's about all the time we have for now. Dr. Ashish Deshmukh, Professor of Public Health Sciences and co-leader of the Cancer Prevention and Control Program at the Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston. We have to take a break, but when we come back, why have we seen so many resignations of editors at scientific journals? We'll break down whether this is a trend and what it could mean for the future of science. We'll be right back after this short break.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Editors at science journals are quitting in droves. According to Retraction Watch, a watchdog publication, there have been at least 20 mass resignations since 2023. So what's going on here? Well, if you look closely, you'll notice a common pattern. Publishers are cutting back on the number of editors, shortening publishing deadlines, charging hefty fees for authors to publish their work. The most recent resignation happened at the Journal of Human Evolution at the end of last year. Both co-editors-in-chief and the entire editorial board quit, except for one person. But what does this mean for the future of scientific publishing? Have these resignations made the big publishers change their ways? Is the strict academic publishing system we know in danger? Well, joining me now to answer these questions are my guests, Dr. Andrea Taylor, former co-editor-in-chief of the journal Human Evolution, and biological anthropologist and professor of anatomy in Vallejo, California, and Ivan Oransky, co-founder of Retraction Watch, editor-in-chief of The Transmitter, and distinguished journalist in residence at New York University's Carter Journalism Institute, based in New York. Welcome both of you to Science Friday.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Ira.
Ivan, did I get all of that right, those resignations?
You did. And I should be clear that there may have even been more resignations than that. We don't claim to necessarily have all of them cataloged, although we think we've probably at least captured most of them. They have been happening, at least we've seen them happening more often over the past couple of years. Whether that reflects them actually happening more or us just noticing or other people noticing them, because we're not the only ones to report on this, is unclear.
Okay, before we dig more deeply into the current state of the scientific publishing industry, I always like to follow the money all the time. Can you give us a brief overview of the business model of scientific journals? I know it's a, what, $19 billion industry with a 40% profit margin. That's pretty healthy, isn't it? I'm not sure most listeners know how much unpaid volunteer labor is also used to prop it up.
Yeah, so, you know, at a high level, there are a couple different or several different ways that publishers make money. And I'm going to miss some here intentionally, but just to bucket them, there's the old-fashioned way, which, of course, we're all familiar with, subscriptions. And those tend to come in various forms. And you might buy, you know, a library, for example, might buy dozens or even hundreds or maybe even thousands of journals subscriptions for their university, for example. That is, you know, in many ways being phased out in favor of what's known as an article processing charge model. Some people talk about sort of an author pays model where in order to make an article not need a subscription, in other words, open access, the authors actually pay, and that can be anywhere from $99 to $12,000 or $13,000 per article, in order that anyone, including you, me, and any scientist in the world, can read it for free. Now, that, to sort of jump ahead a little bit, that has led to massive growth in publications, although that was sort of happening anyway. And it's led to what we're concerned about, a sort of really bad incentive to just publish more and more and more. Well, guess what? Publishing more and more and more makes doing the quality checks, you know, the peer review, which is the sort of technical term for it in science and scientific publishing, it makes that much, much more challenging because you're jamming many, many more papers through an already taxed system. And so what you're seeing with some of these resignations, and in fact, a lot of them, is a real concern that both in terms of equity, in terms of who can afford these charges, and also just in terms of what this means for quality, that editors are saying, you know, as in the old movie, right, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, Andrea, is that what motivated you and the rest of the editorial board to resign from the Journal of Human Evolution?
Yeah, I think that Ivan hit it, the nail on the head, if you will. It's the incentive to publish more papers quickly, and that certainly taxes the system, and our concern about quality. You know, quality and integrity are the things that we focus on, and that's not necessarily in sync with the priorities of faster and more.
Mm-hmm. And to get this collective action, to have so many editors resign together, did you really need to convince them all to get on board, or were they ready to go also?
I think it's important to be clear that this was a profoundly personal decision for every single editorial board member. There was no pressure by anyone for any of members of the editorial board to resign. I can say it was not only deeply personal, but it was an extremely difficult and painful decision to arrive at. It's not the decision we were hoping for.
Mm-hmm. And in the public resignation letter, which you and the other editors wrote about your concerns with the use of AI in the editorial process, I mean, Elsevier, who publishes the Journal of Human Evolution, denies using AI. And you said they were. Can you tell me more about what those concerns were?
since that letter came out, there's certainly been a lot of attention focused on the use of AI. And obviously, we could have an entire show, entire conversation here on simply the use of AI in academia and education and publishing and so on. We appreciate Elsevier's response, and we agree that the extraordinary production issues that we were experiencing in mid-October of 2023, those did resolve within a six-month period. And that's certainly consistent with the statement we issued, that the editorial board issued. We don't know what to make of the statement that AI was never used in production. During a virtual meeting with Elsevier that took place in the fall of 2023, the then joint editor-in-chief that was working with me at the time, and I, we were both in the same meeting, and we were informed that the extraordinary production issues that we were experiencing at that time were somehow related to an AI software that Elsevier was trying to train. Could we have been misinformed? Yes. Could there have been the use of AI that was subsequently suspended? Yes. Do we have any reason to question the veracity of what we heard in that meeting? We didn't. So, you know, all that being said, from our point of view, whatever the cause, the net effect was a new low in terms of production quality for a period of 6 months. And I think the more important question here is, how is it possible that papers that were properly formatted and proofread and so on, when they were accepted, how is it possible that there's no one overseeing that quality before it reaches the author?
Right, right. So what's at stake here in terms of the quality of the scientific research being published if these trends to cut corners continue to accelerate? Ivan, you want to take that first?
You know, Ira, I think we're already seeing the consequences. We have been now for some years. Adam Marcus and I have only been doing Retraction Watch since 2010, although sometimes it feels like longer. And, you know, even in that, what's actually a relatively short period of time, I think, we've seen already an explosion in the number of retractions. And those are only the ones that are being caught. In other words, there are lots of other papers that clearly should be retracted. And so I would argue that the overall quality of the scientific literature, at least percentage-wise, is declining and has been declining. And you can just sort of track it with the volume and just the number of, again, retractions, corrections, other things that should be corrected or retracted. And I think, you know, I'm even more concerned about the reputation hit that publishers and scientists and science and universities and funders are taking, because it's never quite clear if what you're looking at is has actually been checked. Has it been, again, peer-reviewed? And if it has been peer-reviewed, has it been peer-reviewed in a reasonable way? Was it done partly by AI? That's a symptom, I think, to the earlier comments, to the point of the earlier comments that Andrew's making, that's a symptom of the need for volume. And so I just think that if we want to, you know, trust what we read in journals, not as the absolute truth, not as the absolute, this must be correct, but as someone has actually looked at this and told us whether or not, you know, it's likely to hold up or something, some sort of version of that, then we need to be honest about the real strain on the system and whether or not publishing as is now practiced, and science even as is now practiced, because publishing is such an important part of it, is really sort of living up to the ideals, the very, I think, important, critical, and lofty ideals that we all want it to. And right now, I guess I unfortunately have to say I'm not sure it is.
I wanted to clarify something that was said. I want to be crystal clear that the Journal of Human Evolution is a rigorously peer-reviewed journal, and all of the papers that are submitted, those papers are rigorously peer-reviewed in a system in which the editors and associate editors are overseeing that process. So there's never, ever been a question of AI being used in any aspect of peer review, acceptance, and so on.
So your letter outlines other problems, which are changes to how the associate editors are hired, the elimination of a copy editor back in 2019, not the peer review process itself, but just the machinations of having the process going ahead, you know?
You know, that goes back to death by a thousand cuts. You know, here is the loss of a special issues editor. That means the editors that are handling the regular issue papers are now taking on these thematic issues. The loss of a copy editor, that means that, you know, one of the main goals of Journal of Human Evolution, you know, it's an international journal, and the journal receives papers from all over the world. And a copy editor is crucial if we want to aim to reach as wide a readership as possible. We want those papers to be understandable and as accessible as possible.
Do you think that, you know, we're in an era of there are people who want to denigrate science and not trust in science? Do you think this gives them fuel for them saying, hey, you see, even the science editors themselves are resigning?
Absolutely. I mean, Adam and I have been aware of this, again, for something like 15 years, because early on, some groups that, I don't want to say they're denigrating science necessarily. I don't know what their actual motivations are, but they were pushing sort of, intelligent design, which is this idea that is very related to, at the very least, sort of creationism. And it's not a particularly evidence-based idea. I'll get yelled at for saying that, but I get yelled at every day, so I'm good with it. And what we noticed is that they were pointing to our work and saying, oh, see, these guys are pointing out peer review isn't all it's cracked up to be. And there's retractions and there's fraud and there's all sorts of things. And this is at a time when there weren't nearly as many as there are now. So we were very well aware of how all of this can be weaponized. It's ammunition for people who may have their own reasons, may have their own motivations for, again, as you put it, denigrating science, denigrating the scientific establishment or expertise. I will say, though, that most people who we talk to anyway, who are questioning what they see in journals, are either themselves scientists or are fervent sort of advocates for science and the scientific process, even more importantly. And so I think that, you know, the call's coming from inside the house sometimes, and we need to actually listen to it. You know, you're not going to fix the system from the outside, but you may be forced to have to fix the system from the outside if everyone doesn't pay attention to these problems, which are based on incentives.
Well, okay, now that you've had this mass resignation of your editorial board, has it made a dent in the publisher, Elsevier, rethinking their practices?
So that's a great question. I think in most cases, the impetus for these resignations wasn't simply or only to make a point to the publisher. I'd love to say the publishers are listening, but I think the reality is that they probably aren't. But in our case, it really was a matter of ethics and conscience. It wasn't a matter of expecting that the publisher was going to change.
Right. It wasn't a lever you were trying to use.
No.
And Ivan, is there any evidence that these big publishers like Elsevier or Springer Nature are paying attention to these mass resignations?
So they're definitely paying attention. And one thing to note is that although Elsevier has been publicly traded for a long time, Springer Nature, which is another massive publisher, they just had an initial public offering, an IPO, last fall. And it was kind of their third time around. They've been trying it before. But the reason I mention that is that if you read their initial prospectus, and then now they've had one, you know, quarterly earnings call, they're clearly signaling to the market that they can suffer reputation damage in any number of ways. I don't think they called out resignations specifically, but to me, that's in keeping with other things they mentioned, like, you know, retractions, the use of what are known as paper mills to sort of muck up the process and to create real problematic papers that end up getting published anyway, all this sorts of stuff that really does hit them where they live. You know, Wiley, which is another big publisher, their stock price went down 16% when they announced essentially a cascading set of events that involved some really, you know, a large number of retractions and what have you. And so I think there are other levers. I think to the question and to Andrea's point, it's unclear what effect any particular one will have, but we know they're paying attention. And a lot of these editors have gone off to other publishers, often nonprofits, or they do it themselves. And that's an interesting experiment. Too soon to tell how successful that'll be. But, you know, does that do something to change the ecosystem one drop at a time?
Andrea, any idea? Any thoughts of going off independently?
we've had this question before, and the answer's been we're having conversations about having conversations.
And Ivan, I mean, we've seen some of these nonprofits popping up in recent years. I'm thinking specifically like PLOS One, right? Has that not been successful?
PLOS One, obviously successful is in the eye of the beholders, but it's certainly grown, but then it has shrunk a bit in terms of volume of papers. They, like every nonprofit and even like every for-profit company, go through not boom and bust necessarily, but sort of ups and downs. That's a major one that is sort of particularly focused, but there's also operations like MIT Press, obviously associated with MIT, and they've done some really interesting things in terms of this space and making everything open and not necessarily, for example, relying on article processing charges. So I think what we're seeing is a sort of set of experiments, some which will be successful, some won't, that have to do really with the business models, but also with the mission of what publishers are meant to do and what we hope they will do. But it's too soon to tell. It makes it a very interesting time for journalists like me who focuses on these issues. Mm-hmm. But, not sure what will happen yet.
Well, Andrea, good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Dr. Andrea Taylor, former co-editor-in-chief of the Journal of Human Evolution and biological anthropologist and professor of anatomy in Vallejo, California. Ivan Oransky, co-founder of Retraction Watch, editor-in-chief of The Transmitter, distinguished journalist-in-residence, New York University's Carter Journalism Institute, based in New York City. We have to take a break, and when we come back, the Planet Parade happening now in the night sky. Dean Regas is our sky guide. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, I'm asking you to look up and no, not at the ceiling, but at the night sky, like I did this week, where I saw an awesome display of planets. If you like looking at the night sky, this is a great month to do it. And here to tell us what we can see is a guy who's always, well, he always has his head in the sky, Dean Regas, astronomer and host of the podcast Looking Up with Dean Regas. Welcome back, Dean.
Oh, happy to be here.
Let's talk about this being a great month. The flashiest event people are really talking about, the so-called Planet Parade. Fill us in.
Oh, yeah. This is some good marketing. Planet Parade sounds really great. We're going to have lots of planets up in the sky. We've got Venus. We got Saturn. We got Neptune, Uranus, Jupiter, and Mars all visible. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? But a little bit bringing people down to Earth. Six planets sounds good, but four are the ones you can see with the naked eye. But Venus and Saturn are going to be right next to each other in the evening sky right after dark. So Venus, incredibly bright, looks suspiciously bright, like a plane or a UFO. And Saturn will be faint, but next to it. And then on the other side of the sky, kind of more by the south, southeast, is going to be Jupiter and Mars kind of spread out a little bit. Uranus and Neptune, you need a telescope to see. You're going to see it on social media with all six of them and the charts and everything. But I'd say stick with the four. Planet Parade sounds pretty good to me.
And I was like you. I thought I was looking at some airplanes, and they weren't moving. So is this a rare event for so many of them to be visible at once?
We're kind of in the cycle where in the wintertime we're getting this a little bit more often. But it's really just all the planets are on their own tracks going around the sun at different speeds. And so they tend to line up along this plane called the ecliptic. This is kind of the plane of our solar system. So planets like to line up a lot. Seeing all these kind of in one place is pretty cool. And then in case you were wondering where Mercury is, we haven't talked about that. That's going to come around at the end of February and kind of join the parade for a little bit. But that one's always tough to see, too.
And how do you tell whether it's a planet or it's a really bright star?
Yeah, really good question, because some of the planets stand out, like Venus and Jupiter are incredibly bright, brighter than any of the stars. The other ones are a little bit tougher. So Mars is pretty bright right now because we're at closest approach to Mars for the year. And so that just looks like kind of this red, bright star. And Saturn's very faint. So it looks kind of like a normal yellow star out there. But the trick that we always try to tell people is planets twinkle less than stars. So you look for things that aren't twinkling as much. They still will twinkle a little bit, but not as much.
Love it. Yeah, a little more of a disc shape than a point in the sky.
Exactly right.
Yeah, let's move on to another event that's getting a lot of buzz. And I'm talking about the Atlas Comet. What's the deal with this?
Oh man, this sounds great again. This is the brightest comet we've seen in a long time. Its brightness is about as bright as the planet Venus. And so that's hyping up pretty good. Big problem with this comet is the average person's not going to see it, which you're thinking, well, wait a second, it's bright as Venus, I should see it. It is right next to the sun. So from your view, it's up during the daytime. So you need special observing techniques and equipment to actually see this comet. So is it going to be visible to the naked eye? Highly unlikely. I'm a little worried about people trying to stare at the sun too much. So this
their binoculars are something really bad idea.
Yeah. So this comet, it's got a lot of hype. It's got another good press agent, but I think this one's one I'm going to pass on looking for it because it's not going to be easy.
So you're saying it's never going to be visible in the night sky?
It's going to be visible later on. So Southern Hemisphere, it's more visible from that region. For us in the Northern Hemisphere, it's going to be really tough because it's going to fade probably pretty fast as it moves away from the sun. So we do have a chance maybe at the end of January to get a glimpse of it. But when it comes to comets, the rule of thumb is they are fickle beasts and you never know what they're going to do.
I don't recognize the name of this one. It must not come by very often.
Yeah, this is one that astronomers just computed the orbit to be around 160,000 years. So comets live these interesting lives where they're mostly way, way, way out from the sun and they're frozen little ice balls. But when they drift towards the sun, they heat up, create these tails, and that's when you see them. So this comet's going to make a quick skirting of the inner solar system and head back to obscurity for another 160,000 years.
You know, when we pass through the dust of a comet, we get meteor showers, right? Do we have any meteor showers coming up?
Well, we got some minor ones in the wintertime. The next really good one that I've got kind of my eye on is the Lyrids. That's in April, kind of late April, April 21, 22, somewhere around there. That's when we're flying through this comet debris. And every year, there's creating a lot of shooting stars. So that's the next one I've kind of got my eye on because the moon phase will be favorable. So no moon around. That means more chances of seeing fainter meteors. So Lyrids is the one I got circled.
And if you're lucky enough to have a telescope or a nice pair of binoculars, what can you see in the night sky now that would be really cool?
I think the big thing right now that's shining along with the planets are the brightest stars in the year, basically. So the winter sky has the brightest stars. 8 of the top 20 brightest stars in the whole sky are visible every night. It's this area of the sky kind of by Orion. So you think of the belt stars of Orion, those 3 stars in a row. There's plenty of other bright stars around it, which some call a circle, some call a hexagon, but I call it the winter football because it's shaped like a football and I got playoffs on my brain. But you got Orion out there with the Orion Nebula, which is an awesome sight to see through a telescope. You got the Seven Sisters, the Pleiades star cluster, which make a nice sight. There's another one that I want to throw out there to challenge the folks called M35. It's this open star cluster in the constellation Gemini. It's not visible to the naked eye, but when you find it with a telescope, it is awesome.
You got to have a clear sky on that one.
Absolutely. Yeah. The darker the sky, the better. And I hate to say it, the bigger the telescope, the better too.
Have you found that the haze from those terrible forest fires in Los Angeles or other places have been getting in the way of seeing the stars and the planets?
I think a little bit, especially for folks on the west side of the country, that they are kind of affecting this. And they're also affecting a lot of the communication sites, like the Jet Propulsion Laboratory there in California is having some issues they had to evacuate a lot of places. So we're getting a few reports about that. The smoke hasn't drifted extensively yet that we've noticed, at least here in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. And what about these thousands of Starlink satellites that SpaceX and others are putting up? Starlink has now 7,000. They're aiming for 12,000. China is competing with them now, and they're trying to orbit up to 15,000 eventually. Are they affecting what people see in the night sky?
Wow. Yeah. Talk about a controversial subject. This is something everybody's got kind of an opinion on in the astronomical world. Astronomers, by and large, dislike this because more satellites up in the sky, the more times their telescopes and cameras are going to pick up the satellites when they want to pick up things that are much farther away. It hasn't been a large scale disruption of scientific research yet, but it's definitely on people's minds because thousands and thousands of satellites create thousands of reflective objects and also could potentially lead to thousands of things falling from the sky. So this competition of, you know, between the countries, there's not a lot of collaboration. That's the other problem. So everybody that can send a satellite up can do it.
Right. All right. Let's look a little bit into the future for other big astronomical events that are, that you're excited about. Any lunar solar eclipses coming up this year?
Yeah, we got two of them in March, which is pretty exciting. The bigger one of the two, I think, is going to be the total lunar eclipse. That's going to be on the night of March 13th into March 14th. So this is when the moon goes into the shadow of the Earth and turns that eerie blood red color. This is going to be pretty awesome because it's going to be visible across the entire United States. Almost everywhere we'll be able to see that total lunar eclipse that wow. night. So, and this is for people that saw this total solar eclipse back in 2024, this isn't quite the same deal. It's not as mind-blowingly awesome as others. So yeah, this total lunar eclipse is going to be kind of a long affair. It takes several hours to go through the partial stages. And totality, the only problem with totality for this total lunar eclipse in March is going to be the timing. It'll be 2:26 to 3:31 a.m. Eastern time, but I might as well stay up late for it. It's going
to
be cool.
Yeah, yeah. And what's the best way to look at it? You don't need a telescope for this, right? Or binoculars?
Absolutely not. For a total lunar eclipse, you just want to kind of sit back and watch the show. It's one of those, like, it's a chill astronomical event because it takes so long. And my advice is when you get to the totality part, you can watch it and then, you know, have some friends and family out there, get some drinks. Then every time you look back at the moon during totality, it's slightly different. The shade slowly changes and makes a really cool sight.
Dean, you briefly mentioned a partial solar eclipse this year. Let's talk about that.
Oh, yeah. So this is going to be on March 29th. So we got that total lunar eclipse on the 13th, 14th, and then the partial solar eclipse on the 29th of March. This one is only going to be visible from the extreme northeastern part of the United States, where just a little bit of the sun will be blocked out by the moon. So no total eclipse for the United States on that one. But still something cool to see if you're in the Northeast.
Yeah, I love when that happens and then you have the leaves and you see all those little suns on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Maine, that's the best spots to see it. And even then, it's only going to be about halfway eclipse. The sun will be. But, I'm heading up there to see it. So I can't wait.
Half is better than nothing. Right.
The rush of seeing an eclipse of any kind is really cool.
And so it's going to be a busy year. It looks like, you know, there is a total solar eclipse coming up, what, next year? If you want to plan for that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's on my calendar. By the way, I have eclipses on my calendar through 2079. So I'm good. I know where I'm going to be, but 2026 is the next total solar eclipse. And for people that saw the one in 2024, you're probably hooked. And the places to see it in 2026 are Iceland and Spain. So take your pick. I'm thinking Spain, but I'm going to start planning very soon.
Well, we'll plan along with you, Dean. Thank you, as always, for being our sky guide at the nighttime sky.
Absolutely, and keep looking up.
Dean Regas, astronomer and host of the podcast, Looking Up with Dean Regas. Dean is based in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Speaking of looking up, if you get the timing right, you might just be able to catch a glimpse of the International Space Station zooming by above. And if you've ever wanted a peek inside, we have something for you.
Houston Station on 2 for the PAO event. Heads up, we are 20 seconds out from the start of the event. We're ready.
Earlier this week, SciFri connected young listeners directly with astronauts living on the ISS.
ACR, this is Mission Control Houston. Please call station for a voice check.
Astronauts Don Pettit and Butch Wilmore took time out of their astronaut duties to answer questions sent in by students from around the country. And there were some stellar ones that we just had to share.
Hi, my name is Rashiel, and my question is, what is the most surprising experience you've had while living and working in the International Space Station, and how has it changed your perspective on Earth?
Wow, Rashiel, that'd be a hard question to answer with only one comment, because every day is different. Such the variety, looking out the window, different sights you see at different parts of the day and night cycle, hands in a microscience gravity workbox, doing science there, science throughout the space station. So you really cannot pick a single thing. It's all fascinating.
Hi, my name is Tyson. My question is, how does it affect your body when you go into space?
The body does do very many changes. They say, and you can kind of feel it a little bit, that your internal organs kind of shift up into your body a little bit, which is good because it makes you feel thinner. Also, 20-25% of the food we eat actually turns to gas, unless you're Don Pettit, maybe it's a little more. Good question.
And I'd like to add that we change the effective level of gravity by a factor of 1,000,000. That's what microgravity means. And you change any other environmental factor. Say you change temperature by 1,000,000. You'd be turned into a little carbon shard, a different kind of CRISPR. And the fact that human beings can go into space with a factor of 1,000,000 change in gravity and still basically continue on, I find, is an amazing robustness that we as human beings have.
Hi, my name is Alegria. My question is, can you describe what the sunrise looks like when you're on the International Space Station?
Absolutely. When the sun just starts to come up, you get a blue strip across the horizon. And as it continues to get closer and closer to the horizon, you start to see the color, just like a prism breaks down the light. The atmosphere breaks down the white light into the various colors like a prism. And then it's just as the sun is peaking above the horizon, the entire International Space Station turns to an orange color for 5 or 6 seconds. It's pretty amazing. Wonderful to see.
And on Earth, because of Earth's rotation and orbit around the sun, it takes 2 minutes for the disk of the sun to slip below the horizon. On space station, because of our orbital velocity, it takes 7.5 seconds. So you can go from full daylight to full darkness in 7.5 seconds.
If you, like me, just cannot get enough astronaut content, please head to sciencefriday.com/downlink, where you can watch Don Pettit and Butch Wilmore bob around the ISS and hear more from Earthbound astronauts Katie Coleman, Ellen Ochoa, and Nicole Stott, who kept that space chat going. Thanks to NASA and all the astronauts for taking time to chat with us. And thanks to SciFri's Sandy Roberts for leading the charge.
Oh, and one thing more before we go. The SciFri Book Club has just pulled its latest book off the shelf. Book Club Captain Diana Plasker has the title.
Thanks, Ira. Maybe your New Year's resolution is to read more books in 2025. Well, we can help with that. This February, the SciFri Book Club is reading Origin, A Genetic History of the Americas by Jennifer Raff. You can join our online community of book lovers and enter to win a free book at sciencefriday.com/bookclub.
Thank you, Diana. And that does it for this show. If you missed any part of the program or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday.
And you can join us throughout the week on social media or with our newsletter, sciencefriday.com/newsletters. Or email us. The address is scifry@sciencefriday.com.
We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flato.
And I'm Flora Lichtman. Have a great weekend.